live from Chicago. This is Dan Proff substituting for Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Professor Art Sear, former GOP U.S. Senate candidate Pat Hughes, and Professor Khalil Marar. Our program coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in beautiful downtown Chicago, where our toll-free phones are now open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. Our website, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Gentlemen, happy Easter. Thank you so much for joining us. Happy Easter to all of our listeners there. As I said, we'll be taking your calls. I want to start with getting everybody's reaction to the response from the President of the United States to both the attack in Brussels, optically in between the baseball game and the tango, as well as substantively to the question of, are we at war against radical Islamic terrorism globally, or is it more like what President Obama seems to suggest it is, which is some kind of police action? I'll start with Khalil Marar, professor of Middle East policy at Governor State University in suburban Chicago. Khalil.
Dan, thanks for having us. Okay, so two things. It is a sort of a police action on the one hand. At the same time, it is a war against militancy more broadly. And I think that we need to keep those two motivations in mind as we move forward. It's a police action in the sense that it is literally trying to root out terrorists and bring them to justice. And I think that any president, whether it's Republican or Democratic, are right on by rooting out and bringing people to justice. It is a war in the sense that, look, you can't look at Brussels without seeing a pattern, a series of battles, if you will. It's a war in the sense that these people are literally killing innocents. And it's a sort of a war on terrorism in the sense that this is terrorism.
And
this
then
is directed at civilians.
So did you think President Obama's response was proportional to the threat and to the events?
Yeah. You know, context is something there. I mean, you know, this was the quote-unquote opening up of Cuba. And given the sort of historic opportunity, if you will, on both sides, more towards Cuba, and really the momentous occasion of opening Cuba, I think that it was rather muted. And yet at the same time, it was really dwarfed by what took place in Brussels.
Art Sear, he's the director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Thank you.
Art, great to have you with us again.
Well,
Charles
you.
Krauthammer said on Fox News in response to President Obama's response, it was the perfect juxtaposition, the perfect commentary on the foreign policy of this administration. On the one hand, you have the scene at the airport and the subway in Brussels and the carnage. And that's the real world, juxtaposed to the woozy dreamland in which President Obama lives in, where he is sharing a hot dog with his communist dictator friend, Raul Castro. And the complete lack of connection to the seriousness of the events in Europe as compared to the import of this tiny communist island nation. Is that an assessment you would subscribe to as well?
Well, you're making a statement, Mr. Chairman, as well as asking a question.
Yes, I am.
Cuba is not tiny. Before the Bay of Pigs, General Shoup, commander of the Marine Corps, showed President Kennedy and other brass that were in the room a map of Cuba, and there was a black dot that was rather small on the island. And the president, as the general, asked what that was, and he said that's the size of the island of Tarawa, where hundreds of Marines were killed during the Second World War. Cuba is not a small island. It's a big headache for the U.S. still, and I think it's important to keep that in context. To actually answer your question, I think in hindsight, as you know, academics like to be critical, and I'm not a media expert, I think the photo op in Cuba could have been avoided since it's a dictatorship and the president probably should have. Far worse were the San Bernardino killings, from my point of view, a brutal but local murder that's not been directly connected to ISIS or anyone else. The president made an Oval Office speech about this local crime. He then went out there. He transformed a bloody, brutal killing in Southern California into an international incident, and ISIS took credit. I find that more troubling than the conservative media criticism of what's happening currently. I read Charles Krauthammer. I admire his work. He is very conservative, as we all know, and as our listeners and viewers should know.
Speaking of very conservative, Pat Hughes, Chicago-based attorney and former Republican candidate for U.S. Senate in Illinois. Your reaction to President Obama's reaction on Tuesday?
Bad optics and worse policy, Dan. President Obama came into office with the preconceived notion that there really wasn't a war on terror, that it was something less than what the Bush administration or maybe a lot of people on the right thought it actually was. And he's done everything in his first 7 years of office to pretend that his initial thoughts are reality. And the juxtaposition between going to Cuba, and I agree that there's something to be done with Cuba at some point in time, but the, you know, what I believe the existential threat facing the United States is ISIS, and we should be at war with ISIS everywhere they go, and it should be prosecuted as a war and not necessarily in the nature of how John Kerry or Obama would call it a police action. So the optics were terrible, but the more important part is the policy, the aggression, how seriously he seems to take it. That to me is the larger problem.
I want to go to the phrase that you just used, because the president specifically addressed that phrase and rejected it, existential threat. He does not see ISIS as an existential threat. Now, he limited it to ISIS, but it seems to me that is meant to be used as a blanket statement with respect to Islamofascism. He does not see that as a existential threat, whether it's the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or Al-Shabaab or ISIS. Does anyone agree with the president about that?
He doesn't see it as Islamofascism either. You know, and this is something that doesn't just go back to the Cairo speech in 2009. This is something that just basically goes back to the entire record of this person known as Barack Obama. Look, we have to be careful with terms like Islamofascism and existential threat. I mean, the idea that you have these radical militants committing horrible, horrible atrocities in the name of a religion is something that we have to confront, to be sure. But to label it as something that is so exclusive of everything else, what I mean by that is we have to be careful with the way that we label what these fanatics are doing. Now, I'm using terms like fanatics, so I have to be careful with that. What I mean by this is this. The way that we label it will determine our reaction. Our reaction to terrorism is the existential threat.
But if we're unwilling, some of us, starting with the president of the United States, if we're unwilling to call it radical Islamic terrorism, that is a choice. That is indicative, you say, the words you use, indicative of the kind of seriousness of the threat as you perceive it and what you're willing to do in response to that threat. So are you at all troubled by President Obama and John Kerry and the left's unwillingness to use that phrase? And remember the backdrop here, especially this week. The backdrop is the U.S. House voting unanimously to characterize what ISIS is doing in the Middle East as genocide against Christians. And, of course, today on this Easter Sunday, a bombing in eastern Pakistan that I don't know what the last count is, but at least 60 people murdered and another several hundred injured. I want to pick this conversation up after the break, but this idea, is it an existential threat? And as you were saying, Khalil, what that implies if you call it an existential threat or if you don't call it an existential threat. We'll pick that up and take your calls. Again, the number 1-800-723-8289 right after this break.
Eight years ago, there were barely more than 400,000 television homes in the entire country. By 1952, the 400,000 had grown to 18,700,000. By August 13th of 1956, there will be 36,800,000 homes in the United States equipped with television.
For more historic clips, go to museum.tv.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
Good evening, Dan Proft, guest hosting for Bruce Dumont on this edition of Beyond the Beltway. Pleased to be joined by Professors Khalil Morar and Art Sear, as well as Chicago attorney and former Republican Senate candidate Pat Hughes. We've got two JDs versus two PhDs, so obviously the academics are decided to disband, so we're going to give them a little bit more time. We were talking before the break about this phrase, existential threat, that the president explicitly rejected in his response to the Brussels terrorist attacks. And Khalil, you were making the point about the precision of language, the importance in the foreign policy arena of being precise with language. And clarify for me whether you think that the president's choice of language is precise and appropriate, or it is imprecise and inappropriate.
Look, Dan, I mean, reality, and I'm sure everybody would agree with me, is a very complex phenomenon, especially when you're fighting a war against militants or whoever, right? Any war is a complicated idea. You know, and look, I was at a workshop about war recently in Washington, D.C., where every single military leader, I mean, we're talking about four-star generals there, did not agree that ISIS is the greatest threat. I mean, they just chuckled it off. It's beyond the laugh test.
But we would treat it as
an existential threat. So we have to be careful. We have to be careful with naming it what it's not. I mean, talk about elevating something to an international incident.
Well, see, this is the point that Robert Pape makes at University of Chicago, too. Directs the project on security and terrorism there. Very smart guy. But here's the thing. I have that we're being very specific with ISIS. The global jihadists generally, I don't care if they affiliate with al-Shabaab or al-Nusra Front or al-Qaeda or ISIS, the idea of some small percentage of 1.6 billion Muslims worldwide that are intent on pursuing this apocalyptic worldview through violence.
Yeah.
Is that a existential threat or is it not?
I'm an academic. I'm all for big words.
Yes.
I know what existentialism means among philosophers and professors.
Please don't start quoting Sartre.
Don't worry. It's nice that people are using sophisticated words, but I'm not sure what people mean, including Krauthammer. I think they mean it's a strategic threat. No, ISIS is not yet a strategic threat. I think it's possible rhetorically to build them up. It's also important to look at what we're doing as opposed to what our leaders are saying. We are killing a hell of a lot of people. Our drones, we don't know how many people have been killed by American drones, partly because of collateral damage, partly because the government doesn't reveal much.
We just had another ISIS number two killed over the weekend, allegedly. And The Onion reports that's 80% of ISIS's number twos that have been killed. So it seems like they have more than one number two. Yes,
they move up. We are killing a lot of people. I was at a classified, an off-the-record, not classified, dinner in Chicago, the Council on Foreign Relations organized. And a knowledgeable expert said he's confident we've killed at least 150 to 200 people within the last couple of months. Obama has been far more active than Bush or anyone else in using drones. This particular expert also said in response to a question, yes, we are going right up to the top, far more dependent on technology than we are on human intelligence, which is my sense of things. It's very American. It's a big mistake from my point of view.
Using technology instead of human intelligence.
We have to use both. And starting with the Clinton administration, for budgetary reasons, we started developing the default position that whenever we can use technology, whenever we can use electronic means, that's far better than human agents. That's a serious mistake, and that has been U.S. government policy for a couple of decades.
I want to pick what Professor Sear, Professor Morar are saying, Pat, about the president's viewpoint, because it also drives what he did in his radio address yesterday, which is to double down on the I'm bringing 100,000 Syrian refugees here. We have to be in an open and tolerant society. I'm dismissing the detractors. Nothing that's happened in Brussels or Paris before that should deter us from bringing in these Syrian refugees, despite the fact that the FBI director says we can't vet them. Your reaction to this kind of discussion about the threat level that ISIS and radical Islamic terrorism poses in combination with President Obama's doubling down on the refugees?
Well, we should be vetting Syrian refugees to the best of our ability. We need to be an open society, but there are risks to that, and we have to be cognizant of those risks. And the number one goal of the President of the United States is to protect the homeland and the people of the United States. I started this conversation with the term existential threat because I believe that what you set out forth as something beyond ISIS is the existential threat. And what's meant by that is, you know, we are in an age of chemical, biological, nuclear weapons. And, you know, the bomb that goes off in a Pakistan park that kills 200 people or whatever, or the bomb that goes off in a railway station or at an airport that kills 40 or 50 people, if that's a different type of weapon, then you're talking about massive consequences that the president doesn't seem to want to acknowledge. And to me, his lack of using the term existential threat is just his way of disassociating himself from the foreign policy of his predecessor, George Bush, and showing once again that he doesn't view this as a large problem, because going into office, he thought that it was a giant overreach by the Bush administration. And he's doubling down on that despite the evidence.
Well, and see, to me, the response that President Obama offers, that, look, more people are killed on the streets of Chicago. He doesn't use Chicago as an example because that doesn't serve him particularly well. But the idea more people are killed on the streets of Chicago as the result of gang crime than are killed as a result of terrorist activity, that may be true in the short term, and it says something about Chicago. But in addition to that, it also is a little bit Pollyannish, isn't it? Because haven't the Islamic terrorists proven their interest in and capability to scale what they do in a way that shootouts over who controls a corner in the drug trafficking does not really occur? So, I mean, is 9/11 that's so distant in our past that we have forgotten that it doesn't take much with intent to scale the kind of destruction and human tragedy they are capable and desirous of inflicting? Is that a fair statement or not?
Yeah, it is. It's comparing apples and oranges.
Well, he started it.
What?
He started comparing apples and oranges. I mean, the politician saying more gang crime.
You're quite right. During the long, agonizing Vietnam War, more people were killed every year on the highways in America, quite apart from gang or mob or other violence, than died throughout the Vietnam War, about 57,000 people. We had real carnage on the highways. That doesn't change the fact that it was an important war, and an awful lot of people were killed on the other side and are being killed on the other side. It's a false comparison. It really is.
Yeah. Dan, Art, and Pat, I mean, the problem with existential threat, and I don't want to belabor this point, I mean, it doesn't really warrant that much of a conversation, is that we could cease to exist as a nation because of ISIS or Islamic terrorism or whatever you want to call it, Islamofascism. It's laughable, and there's a really somber point that I'm making here, and that is that, you know, it sort of precludes the real existential threat that ISIS is posing to Christians and Yazidis and religious minorities throughout the region that have coexisted with Muslims for 1,400 and some odd years now. So let's not pretend as if they are an existential threat to the most powerful country on earth. We are the most powerful country on earth, and to say that we are that much threatened by ISIS or Islamic fundamentalism is almost like, I don't know, like a lion saying he's threatened by a mouse. I think a more apt way of looking at it, even though there's no perfect way of looking at it, and I admit this, a more apt way of looking at it is to see it as a threat, which it is, first and foremost. Existential threat, it's not. Is it more of a threat than gang violence? Well, let's judge the outcome. I mean, I think that any politician, Republican or Democrat, that looks at the outcome of seatbelt deaths or gang violence, whether it's in Chicago or New Orleans or Baltimore or wherever, I think is rightly pointing to the reality, the fact that a lot of people die. The outcome is the same. Now, seatbelt deaths are not an existential threat, but they sure as heck are a threat that we need to treat seriously. Maybe not in the same camp as ISIS. We need to deal with those things at the same time.
What about Western Europe? I mean, in Belgium, not only the attack at the Brussels airport and the Brussels subway station, but also the reports about security personnel at a nuclear power plant in Brussels. One was killed. Four others had their identification stolen, obviously trying to go to the nuclear, incur the nuclear facility. There's been a lot of talk, not effective. There's been no effective attack of this sort yet, but about trying to attack our grid or attack the power grids of Western European nations. I mean, you know, at what level do we start to say, I mean, this could actually This is actually a fight between civilization and uncivilization, and it could actually undo civilization, maybe not here, and maybe not as quickly as could happen in Europe, but in places like Belgium that have been asleep at the switch, apparently. Is that possible, or is that not possible
either? I'm always introduced as a policy expert, and one of the things that I'd like to implore you, Dan, and everybody else that uses such colorful terminology as a clash of civilization or civilization versus uncivilization is, like, what does that look like in policy? I don't think anybody at this table is capable of telling me exactly how civilization versus uncivilization would translate to policy. I mean, what do we do? Like nuke the Middle East? Is that what you folks want?
Right? No, and I don't think anyone said we're going to nuke the Middle East. The policy is to try to root out every single person, every Islamofascist terrorist who's trying to kill Christians and non-believers and everything
else.
Okay,
that's the end.
What's very scary about this, and which is different than seatbelts or whatever else you guys have been discussing, is the motivation behind why they do this. You know, back when we were in a giant Cold War against the Soviet Union, we had the notion that there were two civilizations that wanted to stay alive. They wanted to prosper against each other, and that sort of fight between the civilizations and their wanting to stay around is what kept us from, you know, blowing each other up ultimately. Mm-hmm. These guys don't care about any of that. They don't care. And so I go back to my main
point. These guys, ISIS, you mean?
ISIS, okay. And everyone associated. Okay.
I want to pick this up on the other side as well as take some calls. We've got some people waiting online to participate in the conversation. But I also want to ask the question, can you separate Islam the religion from Islam the system of governance? Because it seems to me that's the critical distinction. And I'll get your reaction to that question and that position. Take your calls, 1-800-723-8289. Dan Proft in for Bruce Dumont on this edition of Beyond the Beltway.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be, where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Dan Proft back on this edition of Beyond the Beltway, joined by Khalil Marar. He's a professor of Middle East policy at Governor State University in suburban Chicago. Art Sears, the director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Yeah. And Pat Hughes is an attorney practicing in Chicago, as well as a former Republican U.S. Senate candidate. We're talking about the threat that's posed by radical Islamic terror. Is it overblown? Does it get kind of bastardized by some of the conversation on talk radio of all places, as well as the political discourse from the presidential candidates. We've been hashing that around. I want to get to this question, though, because I think it's an important one. I had the opportunity on this morning show that I do on AM 560, Monday to Friday, 5 to 9 a.m., AM 560, Chicago's Morning Answer. A little shameless plug there for me. But I had the opportunity to talk to Dr. Zudi Jasser, who runs the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. And he seemed to agree with me about this being a fundamental question. He is one of, when people say, where are the moderate Muslim voices? Where is the leadership from the Muslim community? He is one of those people, I would say, that fills that void. And he essentially agreed that this idea of separating Islam, the religion, from Islam, the system of governance, is the mission critical challenge. And I wonder, Khalil, if you agree with him, this idea of no-go zones in Europe where the laws of the nation don't apply or they're not enforced, and just more generally what ISIS and other terrorist organizations want to do, which is impose Sharia law in the territory they lord over, separating the religion from Islam as a system of governance. Is that a fair dichotomy to present?
No. Okay. And Zohidi, I mean, he has some things right, but I think he has a lot wrong. I mean, the idea that you don't have a separation between Islam, the religion, and politics is also not true. I mean, you look at a place like Syria, that's exactly what we had. So, look, this is the problem as I see it, as somebody who studies the region extensively, as somebody who's been following ISIS way before it was ISIS, it's, you know, even before it was al-Qaeda in Iraq. You have these organizations that are basically trying to impose what they call Sharia and Islam on people that really don't, frankly, want it. Now, here's the problem. The problem is that because people don't want it, and because the only alternative to ISIS right now, let's face it, let's talk about policy and implications for policy, is the Syrian regime. The uncomfortable question that I'm left with is this. Are we better off? It's the old Saddam Hussein question that my Republican friends used to ask. Are we better off with Bashar al-Assad in power in Syria? Not that that's an option right now. We can talk about the implications of that later, right? Or with ISIS taking over? I mean, that's the reality that most people in the Middle East, most folks in the Middle East and North Africa are presented with. And it's a very terrifying reality. That's why they're fleeing to Europe. And that's why you have this radicalization, because Europeans are not embracing Muslims as Europeans or as Belgians. They're basically leaving them as Muslims.
So I mean, just to be clear on this, I mean, is that – and let bring Pat and Art in on this too. Is that what's happening? Because that's essentially what Evan Coleman, who's a terrorism analyst for NBC5, said. Right. You have the ghettoization of the Muslim neighborhoods in Belgium. So what are we not doing, or what is Belgium not doing, to use this example – of assimilating them into Brussels community life. Is that what's happening, or do we have a bit of a fifth column action actually happening in Western Europe?
Yeah.
Art, Pat?
Yeah, no, I think it's more of a fifth column. I mean, I think that this sort of knee-jerk reaction, and this is sort of world liberals are attuned to do this, and I don't mean to put Khalil in that group, is to what could we have done to prevented this? What could we have done to make these people feel more welcome? Oh, well, if they had jobs, if we accepted their religious beliefs.
The jobs for terrorists.
If we didn't make fun of them on the street, what could we have done? And the reality of it is that isn't what we're facing. It's not what we're facing. It's not what they're facing in Europe. It's not what we would be facing here in the United States. Most people in Western Europe, most people in the United States are tolerant people. The vast majority of people are tolerant people. So what instead we're facing is sort of this sickness that is getting out of ISIS in one spot and making its way into Western Europe, into Belgium, into these other places. That's what's happening, and it's infecting sort of the rest of the population in there, not the other way around.
Art?
To address your initial question, these states in the Middle East, but also elsewhere in the world, were established largely as secular states after the British and French and other colonialists left. Traditional religious figures, the monarchies were overthrown, most notably by Gamal Nasser, a secular junior officer in the Egyptian army. He personified younger officers who took over in Syria. They're secular states. Iran was notable because it was the return of a traditional fundamentalist state, something really new in the post-colonial era. The largest Islamic population in a single country is in Indonesia. Indonesia was a big problem during the Cold War. They had become virtually, in military terms, a Soviet satellite. A big reason we went into Vietnam in the mid-60s, totally ignored today. There was a terrorist strike in Indonesia quite recently. Some people were killed, including some Europeans and Canadians. The government reacted fiercely against them. It's a state that still has some corruption. It's a state that isn't ideal from our point of view, but they've got a reasonably well-functioning democracy, and the fundamentalists have gone nowhere. In 1965, the British very effectively intervened with a small force to stymie an Indonesian attack on Malaysia. Indonesia was a big problem and a very corrupt and radical problem. They're not anymore.
I don't know if
you'd agree with that, but we've got to look at what the media is not obsessing about. We've got to look at what candidates, especially Republicans, are not obsessing about.
Let's get some of our friends in the listening audience who've been waiting. No. We're taking your calls, 1-800-723-8289 again. 1-800-723-8289 is the toll-free number to call in and join the conversation. Let's go to Greg in Schaumburg watching us on YouTube, the Beyond the Beltway page on YouTube. Greg.
Thanks, Dan. I'd like to address this specifically to those who are on the panel that are basically discounting the existential threat concept. And let me amp up the existential threat definition to its ultimate, meaning that I'm about to make the case very succinctly that we are at a stage right now, based on an article that was penned in about 2001 by a Harvard JFK government guy named Ivan Oregutov. And it's basically the story of how the weak win wars. And what I'm really amazed that you guys are not addressing is the role of communication on the unknown factor relative to what Dan was talking about, 10% of the Muslim radical world that wants to come in and annihilate us.
Thanks for the call, Greg. Who wants to tackle that one? Khalil?
You know, I don't know where he gets his 10% figure from. I do know that there's a lot of radicals who happen to call themselves Muslims. I do know that those radicals have committed atrocities in the name of religion. And I also know that one of the first things that prompted al-Qaeda into existence, I'm not even going to take it back to Afghanistan. Let's talk about tomorrow, not yesterday or 10 years ago or 50 years ago. What prompted al-Qaeda into action is specifically what the motivation of Osama bin Laden was, which is really the motivation of his master, Abdullah Azzam, which is getting the West, getting colonization, getting the colonial regimes, getting the secular regimes out of the Middle East, out of the Muslim world, right? That's their mission, is to get rid of secularism, mm-hmm. get rid of colonialism. And they lump the two in the same camp. In that respect, the sad reality is that the radicals are enemies of not just the states of the region, some states anyway. We'll talk later about Saudi Arabia and Oman and Qatar and so on, right? But they're also enemies of the people. They're also enemies of Islam insofar as there's no bigger threat to Islam as we know it in the region or anywhere else than these Muslim radicals that are frankly giving it the worst name that a religion, any religion, could have.
Is what's happening in the assessment of this panel, anybody jump in, is what's happening the result of the death throes of ISIS in Syria and Iraq?
Point. That's a great question.
Because now let's just frame this for people.
Yeah.
You see ISIS losing territory in Iraq and particularly Syria, Palmyra taken back.
Yeah.
That was reported today. Now, the flip side is in Iraq, you still have Iraqi soldiers running away from them in Mosul.
That's true.
That's not good. But ISIS losing its grip on Syria and Iraq, so striking out against feeding people into Europe to strike out against the West to maintain at least an appearance of strength. Is that something that could be part of the dynamic here?
Look, I mean, Robert Pape and I disagreed about this very point on a couple of shows, right? So one point is this. One point is that this whole death throw thing, right? Now, the question is why. The loss of territory, Dan Proft and others, is exactly what people like Pape are talking about. ISIS is losing territory, and therefore they're lashing out. But I think the fundamental issue even preceding territory, and the fact that they're even losing territory, is the fact that they're losing hearts and minds. That's a serious reality that ISIS has to live with, confront, deal with, that nobody's really taking note of. And I think you're right to point out that they are in their death throes. The question is why. Is it the loss of territory, or is really the loss of territory the fact that ISIS is losing supporters from within the community of Islam, from within the Ummah, right? And worldwide, obviously, right? They're not getting the kind of zealous recruits that fundamentally believe that they're waging a war against for something that is just. They're basically getting sickos, psychos. You said the term illness. I like what you're saying. The psychopaths that are basically interested in killing, raping, and so on.
Let's go to James in Hollywood, Florida. James.
Hi. Thanks for having me on, guys. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Hey, James.
You know what, you guys? I have been paying close attention to the Syrian war now since it erupted back in 2011. And, you know, if we look at comments from our former Defense Intelligence Agency Deputy Director Michael Flynn, he gave an interview.
James, quickly. We're up against it, James, quickly.
Right, well, where I'm getting at that ISIS works for Israel. It's the elephant in the room. ISIS has never attacked Israel one time.
Okay, James, thanks for the call.
Base.
Sorry, we got to jump. We'll pick it up on the other side of this break. Dan Proft in for Bruce Duman on this installment of Beyond the Beltway.
The beauty of Amlink's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE. The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Right. Dan Proft in for Bruce Dumont on this edition of Beyond the Beltway. Happy Easter to one and all those that celebrate Easter. And we were talking about terror, but I want to switch gears, talk a little presidential politics. Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders, 70% or more of the vote yesterday in all of Washington, Hawaii, and Alaska. He's won 5 of the 6 Democrat contests this week. If it weren't for the superdelegates, Bernie Sanders would be closer to Hillary Clinton than Ted Cruz is to Donald Trump, and we're talking about a contested convention on the Republican side of the aisle, at least the prospect of it. What does the continued success of Bernie Sanders mean for Hillary Clinton? What does it say about the Democrat Party, since we are spending so much time obsessing about the Republican Party in our discourse because of Donald Trump? Pat Hughes, start with you.
Bernie Sanders is like the crazy uncle that won't leave your house, literally. Like, he literally is that person. He's sticking around. The reason he's sticking around is Hillary Clinton is unpopular in her own party because she's not a very good candidate. She's got a lot of really bad baggage. A lot of people think that Sanders gives more hope for their viewpoints, particularly young people, college-educated young people who really love Bernie because they want free stuff. Look, the thing that I think is incredible about this
is how because he's an older person.
It's how the, it's how the media doesn't talk about the rift on the Democrat side because they're spending all their time on the rift of on the Republican side. But what you have here is an avowed socialist in an American Republican and saying that he wants to be president of the United States and is getting an enormous amount of support for that policy position. And all anybody in the media can do is talk about how crazy Donald Trump and Ted Cruz is. So it's an amazing juxtaposition with respect to that. But Clinton, what it shows to me, I think Clinton's ultimately going to win. But what it shows to me is she is
win the primary.
Win the primary. We're extraordinarily beatable. Indictment or no indictment come next November.
So, Professor Sear, what about that? The prospect of Bernie Sanders doing so well, believes he can run the economy on Vermont maple syrup. It's kind of a stunning development, isn't it?
It is and it isn't. He may be the crazy old guy, uncle, grandpa in the family, but a lot of the members of the family, especially younger ones, really like him. He is an engaging, determined campaigner. He's showing remarkable energy, and he's not an insider. My understanding is he really drives people nuts in Washington in both parties because he's such a maverick. He has not caucused regularly with the Democrats. Traditionally, socialism involves nationalization of industry, and he seems to be a much more pragmatic socialist.
Who is he caucusing with if he's not caucusing with the Democrats? Himself? He must be caucusing by himself.
He's an army of one.
I want to emphasize I'm not an insider. I don't want to be ousted from office.
Exactly. That's right.
But
the torch is out for you.
Yeah, he caucuses with the Democrats, and he can be a real pain in the neck from what's available in the public media. But he's also a very shrewd campaigner. And he's a hardscrabble guy from New York who started at the bottom almost economically. He's fought hard throughout his career for left-wing causes.
He's authentic, replying
directly to some of the comments, and people like that.
And he's still getting used to working because he didn't get his first job until he was like 41. So he's still kind of getting used to this idea.
And most of his supporters hope they can follow in his footsteps. By the way,
I'm not sure that's fair.
Here's the thing about Bernie. I don't want to get too deep in the weeds in terms of the machinations, but this is important because of what Art Sear said about him being an outsider.
Yeah.
The idea that you have these super delegates, that it's a very close race, except for the party insiders, and that's where Hillary Clinton spreads out the race because she's up among superdelegates like 469 to 69. And so if Trump is the nominee, you're going to have all these Trump supporters walk from whoever the Republican nominee would potentially be. What about the prospect of Bernie Sanders walking if Hillary's the nominee, particularly because they feel perhaps that she's illegitimate because it was party insiders that plucked her from a contest and put her up as the nominee? What do you think about that?
You know, I think there's a lot of consternation and really fear within the Democratic Party about the process that's unfolding. But I want to back up a little bit to answer your question this way. And I want to say that Bernie Sanders is popular for the same reason that Donald Trump is popular. And I think that the same playbook that's being used against Hillary Clinton will be used right now with Bernie Sanders, vis-a-vis Bernie Sanders, will be used against her vis-a-vis Donald Trump. And this is why. People view Bernie Sanders as an outsider. He's not. I mean, I remember reading about Bernie Sanders when I was like an undergrad in one of my first political science courses, and now I have a PhD in political science. So he's an outsider. He's not. I mean, the guy's been around Congress for a long, long time. Donald Trump being an outsider, that's like saying we're outside of the studio right now. I mean, he is no outsider. None of those people are outsiders. But I think that the popularity of Donald Trump's popularity and Bernie Sanders' popularity coexist and literally create a disturbance and possibly even an existential threat. Sorry to use the term lightly.
Oh boy, wow. This is where the existential threat is.
For both the Republican and the Democratic Party, because there's a lot of disgruntled Americans out there, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen. And when you have 80% of the country thinking that the country is going in the wrong direction, I mean, God help all the political parties and us all.
Well, here's
something seriously rotten in Denmark.
I think there's something to what both you and Art have said. And Victor Davis Hanson writes in National Review Online. He summed this up months ago. He said, basically, here's the thing with Trump. And to some extent, I think it's Sanders as well. All those elites in academia and media and government and entertainment, D.C., I know them all. And they're even worse than you think.
Hmm.
And Donald Trump is the guy who's going to take the bicycle chain to the playground against all those people who have fleeced you at your expense. And I think Bernie Sanders is offering a different varietal of that same kind of populism.
He is. And I think it's literally the sort of far left equivalent of whatever Donald Trump is selling. I'm not sure it's far right. I don't know what the heck the guy's selling.
Well, what about Obama's role in this? I mean, if winning is the populism in a word of 2016, wasn't hope the populism in a word of 2008? Isn't this cult of personality following cult of personality?
It is. And Obama obviously bears the brunt of why we have Sanders and why we have Trump, right? People are dissatisfied with Washington. And from my perspective, President Obama is the number one person in Washington. I don't think that's can be disputed. And people are dissatisfied with what has happened both domestically and internationally under his watch as president, and I think that there's blame that can be passed around for both parties in the Congress as well. What I think is really interesting about this, Dan and gentlemen, is there are polls showing what would Clinton do against Trump, and she'd beat him, et cetera, et cetera. What would Clinton do against Cruz or vice versa? I don't think anybody knows, because I think that some of these Sanders voters, I think they're going to go to Trump. I don't think they're going to go to Clinton. And I think potentially vice versa. I don't think the Trump voters are necessarily going to go to Cruz. They may go to Sanders or Clinton. It's a strange dynamic.
Well, we'll pick up this conversation on POTUS politics and the very colorful race, including the war of words over wives, on Beyond the Beltway right after this.
Eight years ago, there were barely more than 400,000 television homes in the entire country. By 1952, the 400,000 had grown to 18,700,000. By August 13th of 1956, there will be 36,800,000 homes in the United States equipped with television.
For more historic clips, go to museum.tv.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City. At HiltonUniversal.com, they let you be the star in Hollywood.
Beyond the Beltway, I'm pleased to be joined by a round table of enlightened folks, starting from my left. He is Khalil Morar. He's a professor of Middle East policy at Governor State University, which is in suburban Chicago, University Park. And we have Art Sear, frequent guest, as is Khalil. Art Sear is the director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin, Paul Ryan territory.
Thank you. Yes, indeed. Yeah. He's giving our commencement address. Our president, Greg Woodward, should be commended with
very
emphasis
nice.
For lining him up.
Yeah. Very nice. That's that's a tough get, so that's very good.
Yes, indeed.
And then Pat Hughes is a Chicago-based real estate attorney and also a former Republican candidate for U.S. Senate. And so we were just talking briefly about Bernie Sanders and his great week electorally, 5 out of 6 contests Bernie Sanders wins. Donald Trump had a good week, kind of a split decision, Arizona and Utah. As anticipated, although his margin in Utah exceeded the proverbial polling averages going in. So, you know, it seems like all those people that want to say Donald Trump has this ceiling, he keeps raising that ceiling, at least in some states, and piling up delegates. He now has 60% more delegates than Ted Cruz. There's still talk of a contested convention, but if Donald Trump cannot be stopped on April 5th in Wisconsin, and that is a very tight race right now, if he goes on to win big delegate-rich states like New York and ultimately California, the final election on June 7th, then there will be no contested convention. He will be the Republican nominee. And Republican National Chairman Reince Priebus has said if he gets 1237 plus, then he is the Republican nominee. End of story. Pat Hughes, your take on the Trump trajectory and where you see this going into Wisconsin and beyond.
Yeah, I agree with the chairman that if he gets the 1237, he's the nominee, fair and square. If he doesn't get to it, if Cruz wins Wisconsin, he's got a very good chance of winning Wisconsin. Scott Walker is coming out behind him, and that race is moving a little bit, and he does well going down, and Trump doesn't get to that number, then I think it's going to be a contested convention, and I can't imagine that Trump's going to come out of that as the nominee. So those, to me, are the two versions of it.
But let's just stop right there. And we'll take your calls on this, too, by the way. 1-800-723-8289 is our toll-free number, 1-800-723-8289. If Trump comes short of 1237, but it's like 1150 or 1200, and Ted Cruz is a distant second, the idea of either Ted Cruz or John Kasich, who, you know, has won Ohio, I know, and that's all John Kasich looks like he's going to win. I mean, he's making a play in Pennsylvania, but it's still Trump's to lose. If that happens, if Trump is substantially close to that requisite delegate count and somebody else is handed the nomination on a 4th or 5th or 52nd ballot at the convention, what happens to Trump supporters?
Well, first off, you asked me what I thought was going to happen, and that's what I think is going to happen.
Yeah, so continue.
And it's a really, really good question. I think that there's enough people within the party who are arrogant enough, and arrogance within both political parties runs amok, as you know, to think that they'll have enough time to sell whoever that other candidate is. And I'm not convinced it'll be Cruz or Kasich. It could be somebody else. I don't know. Yeah. With the idea of in the next 60 or 90 days, you could sell them on this idea of having someone else. I think that's the mood inside the Republican Party. Whether that's suicidal or not, I don't know. But that's what I think the mood of the party is.
Well, I mean, Art, what's your sense of the suicidal nature, potentially, of giving the nomination to someone other than Trump, whether one of the candidates that has less wins and less delegates or somebody that wasn't even participating at all? It seems to me there's the movement afoot among some conservatives to try and find a third-party independent conservative candidate to run against Trump. That hasn't produced a lot of compelling names either.
I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not being modest. I find Trump so disgraceful and disturbing as a candidate, and I'm convinced it's not just because I'm old. Such a break from civilized behavior that I think he'd be unacceptable as a president. He could get elected, but I think every effort to stop his candidacy within the Republican Party is justified, and that's why we have conventions, and delegates are only committed on the first ballot. Since 1860, the Republicans have consistently given delegates freedom. Abe Lincoln was not the front runner in 1860. We can all thank God on Easter and every other day of the year that he was, in fact, elected and so successful. The last contested convention, Reagan launched a tremendous challenge against Gerald Ford in 76, but the last actually contested convention was in 52. Dwight Eisenhower, the great magician, was not the front runner. He just made it seem that way after he was nominated and got the White House, but he was behind, but he was nominated.
But here's the problem. There is no Ike. There is no Reagan. There is no Lincoln, you know, off stage waiting to be recruited to be the nominee.
Those are some big names,
I don't see anybody that fits that description.
But that's why we have,
that's me.
That's why we have conventions, and that's why the founders consciously avoided and put a lot of barriers in the way of direct democracy. We're paying the price of appealing directly to the mob today. I'm not overstating the case. This is just an awful, disgraceful situation, and each and every one of us, not just Trump voters, should think very carefully about why we've created a society, in my view, a decadent society, that allows someone like this to come this close to national
power.
Well,
so I want to pick up on that because this is the point that we're not having enough of a conversation about within Republican circles, and I've been beating this drum on my morning show on AM 560 that I do Monday through Friday, and that's this. How did we get to this point? Trump is not the cause of the decay of America or America's lack of greatness. He's a symptom of it. So what are the fights that all of us have not fought, not taken up? Where have we capitulated and allowed the culture to degrade to such an extent that you could give rise to the two most unlikable, untrustworthy people in the country as the respective nominees of the two major parties, Khalil?
Look, I mean, one thing that Art isn't mentioning is that the founders never really foresaw parties either and really called them factions. They abhorred them. They thought they were divisive. But you're right. I don't think that Trump or the political parties are actually causing this. I think there's a fundamental shift, shall we call it, in the culture. Some may call it decadence or decay, but, you know, American culture has always looked decaying and decadence. I mean, I think that's part of our greatness is that, you know, we could both be decaying and morally upright. But one thing, and this really sort of traverses the two issues that we're talking about, you know, Islam in America, Islam in Europe, and really sort of, you know, the nature of the American creed. You know, one thing that I think we really need to renew, and I've been talking about this to radio shows in the past week, in the wake of the tragedies in Brussels, is a renewal of the civic culture. I think we've lost that in this country, and it doesn't have to be, you know, under God or under any one specific creed. I mean, that's the beauty of America is that we've always been a multiplicity of inclusive creeds, like this idea of taking people on. My gosh, I mean, the fact that we're surrounded, literally, not just at this table, but we're surrounded by people of all faiths and walks of life that call themselves American, really is a testament to the rejuvenating element of the national creed. And I think we need to renew that, the American creed.
That is.
Here's why I think it's hard to do that. Because the national conversation that we would be having to renew that creed, so many people, and from my perspective, so many people on the left would shout down the opposition. If I was to say something about marriage, I'd be called a homophobic. If I was to say something about immigration, I'd be called a racist. If I was to say something about how stupid college kids are because they're so privileged they don't realize it, I'd be called, you know, whatever. So the point is, it's very difficult to have that conversation because half the country has no interest in having it. And that's what's given the rise to Trump. The voiceless, people who have been told to sit down and shut up, that you're privileged and you should be happy for what you have, that's giving a rise to Trump.
I want to pick up on Trump and culture as well as get to this dirty business of wives and allegations of infidelity. And I'll do that right after this break.
Eight years ago, there were barely more than 400,000 television homes in the entire country. By 1952, the 400,000 had grown to 18,700,000. By August 13th of 1956, there will be 36,800,000 homes in the United States equipped with television.
For more historic clips, go to museum.tv.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
Dan Proff sitting in for Bruce Dumont on this edition of Beyond the Beltway. Thank you for joining us. Our guests from my right, Pat Hughes, Chicago attorney and former Republican Senate candidate. Art Sear, frequent guest. He is the director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College in Kenosha.
Thank you.
And Khalil Morar, he's a professor of Middle East policy at Governor State University, which is in suburban Chicago. We're talking about Trump and the GOP race. And I want to pick up on the conversation where we left it off, which is Trump and culture. And, you know, Trump follows our culture. The law follows our culture. But this point that you were making, Pat Hughes, before the break, that essentially the way I hear it is people that were living and have been living small C conservative lives, they play by the rules that were set forward. I pay my bills. I take responsibility for my actions. I've done everything that I said that people said I was supposed to do. And now I'm the bad guy. Well, go pound sand. And what they have in Donald Trump is a vessel to tell people to go pound sand.
That's exactly right. I mean, and it's I'm the bad guy is really the thing, right? Instead of just being told, hey, you know, things aren't going to get any better for you, they're being told that they're privileged. They're being told that their opinion doesn't matter. They're being told that their thoughts are racist and homophobic and misogynistic. They're being told terrible things about themselves. And they're saying, that's not who I am. And they're saying it en masse. And Trump, in my view, is a totally imperfect vehicle, but he's a vehicle that gives voice to them in the same way other major movements, including the Reagan Revolution in a different way, gave voice to that, you know, that group of folks back in the late 70s and early 1980s.
And it's been interesting that the party's response and trying to stop Trump, and this becomes very binary, but they're not trying to explain anything. So, for example, one of the stats that's used by both parties, particularly Sanders and Trump, is this idea that middle-income families, their household income has declined in the last 15 years. In real dollars, you're down $3,000 to $5,000.
That's true.
Well, Mark J. Perry, who's an economist at the University of Michigan, he did a little regression analysis on that with context. And you know what explains about 90% of the stagnation of middle-income families' wages? The number of people in this country, it spiked, not working, and the decline in the number of double-income households. So essentially the decline in the number of single income households and the decline in the number of double income households.
Right.
So there are choices being made in terms of family structure that also are impactful on economic stability. And it doesn't seem surprisingly to me that the Republican Party wants to make that point.
No, they don't. And I don't think any party wants to make that point. I mean, nobody wants it to have the honest conversation that the reason why people are not working is not because they're lazy. People want a job. They're not working because the jobs aren't here. And the question is, how do we actually bring them back? There's a cry in America for a more educated workforce. That's fundamentally what the academy is supposed to produce an educated workforce, and yet here in Illinois, we're cutting funding to academics, sadly. We're going the opposite way. You know, you want to talk about a culture of corruption or a culture of decay. I think it starts from the top, and we have to be very careful to not simply reflect public opinion back at the public, but to actually find solutions. We don't have people being employed fully, or full employment, as Perry would put it, and others.
Well, it's funny, too, because at 4.9% unemployment, that used to be the number for full employment. Yeah. And but yet you have Bernie Sanders and even Bill Clinton running around saying we need to move past the bad last 8 years and we need a policy revolution, according to Bernie Sanders. Well, wait a second. A policy revolution after 8 years of Barack Obama? Wasn't that supposed to be the policy revolution, Art?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people feel discontented, and that goes beyond statistics. It's important to keep in mind that we remain the largest, by far, exporter as well as importer of goods in the world. Wisconsin is a principal center of high-quality instrumentation and manufacturing goods and processes of all kinds, thanks to our German population, among other things. Yeah. We compete directly with Germany. Automation means that we're discussing Southeast Wisconsin and the decline of auto jobs over time. That's palpable. At the same time, we're making and exporting more than ever. It's important to keep that reality in mind because of this baloney about jobs going overseas. What we have is a lot of dislocation and economic change. We are the largest agricultural exporter and importer in the world. Everybody knows that in the Midwest, including Illinois and Wisconsin. We had 50% of the population on farms in 1900. We now have a farm population that's no more than 2%. There's a tremendous amount of change going on, which is dislocating people. I've got a job. I'm very grateful. Life is tough if you don't have a job, whatever your age. But a lot of the discontent that's being fed, I think, is in many ways more cultural, what you gentlemen were talking about, rather than truly economic. One-fifth of the truck maintenance jobs where I work around Lake Michigan are vacant all the time. They were vacant during the Great Recession. It's not just a guy with a wrench and an oily rag, as you know. You need computer skills to do that kind of thing. Welding jobs are always available. Janitorial jobs are always available. Welding is dangerous, and the kind of labor I'm describing is unpleasant.
Well, one of Marco Rubio's best moments in the campaign was during a Fox Business debate end of last year, where he said, you know, we need more welders and less philosophers coming out of academia, right? I mean, it's great to major in medieval poetry, but you need to have marketable skills in this global economy.
Right.
So what about K through 12 education as well in terms of vocational training and higher ed in terms of producing, and I'm a fan of liberal arts education, but producing young people with skills if you can't write code for apps, other skills that are marketable in the digital 21st century digital economy.
Yeah, I think, Dan, that, you know, I'm a fan of liberal education, too, and I think there has to be some base in the liberal arts. But what's happened in higher ed, and these gentlemen can speak to it better than I can, is we've gone so far off the reservation of what are, you know, learning actual job skills or things that can be useful in a changing market economy, in a world economy, with some of the majors and some of the things that are being studied. And in large measure, a lot of these people that are going into college are frustrated. They're saddled with debt. They don't want to take a job that isn't, you know, appealing to them, and they don't think they should have to. And so a lot of the reasons why these jobs are unfulfilled is there's a cultural shift in America where, you know, a prior generation before my dad's generation, my dad would have taken any job you would have given him so he could, you know, provide for his family or do whatever. That sort of ethic has changed a little bit across the board. We're more entitled than we've ever been. We think we should have a particular type of job. This isn't the job that I was trained for. And so there's a cultural thing there as well in addition to a training.
Well, right. We're kids until we're 26 under Obamacare. What about that? Do you see that on college campuses, the entitlement mentality?
No. Look, I mean, there's going to be a lot of problems anytime you have a society that's not providing for the needs of its members. And one of the needs that we have as a society is this idea, first and foremost, that our leaders would not sit around a round table and basically say, let them eat cake. There's a real problem in America. And, you don't have to be the person that works six or seven jobs doing god-awful things in order to feed your family. You could be sitting at this table to understand that there's a fundamental shift, not just in the culture. The culture simply tracks what's happening economically and socially and politically. And I don't think that what we have in America is a culture problem. I think we have an economic problem first and foremost. We have a social problem first and foremost. We might have a problem with ethics, but because times are very dangerous, ethics are the first things that got thrown out in Nazi Germany, for example. Philosophy is the first thing that got thrown out in all dictatorial states. In North Korea, they don't prohibit welding. They prohibit philosophy. And the reason they do that is because philosophy is dangerous. Thinking outside the box is dangerous. Liberal education is dangerous. And I'm glad that we all here are liberally educated. Yeah, that's what allowed us to lead in the first place.
Speaking culturally, what's going on at major universities throughout the nation, and minor ones for that matter, as it pertains to academic freedom, as it pertains to those conversations and exploring different schools of philosophical thought and being able to disagree without having your academic record torn asunder or being jettisoned from the college campus. I mean, are college campuses still incubators of intellectual freedom and deep thinking?
Of course they are. Of course they are. There's always going to be people that basically don't like that, but of course they are, and they're the last bastion we have. And that's precisely why we should not be cutting funding to education. We should be increasing it right now, especially to higher education, but also K-12.
When the people who run K-12 and run higher education prove that they take the money that they have and do something useful with every dollar, then I'll talk about whether or not we want to actually increase funding. You want to give more money to K-12 education in the Chicago public school system where they're not educating anybody and they're going to walk out on April 1st because they're not getting, you know, a 7% payment on their already overstuffed pension. Or at these universities where the University of Illinois, I think, costs $50,000 a year to go to the University of Illinois to get a degree in women's studies. Look, throwing more money at a problem isn't the solution to that problem until we recognize what we're getting for the dollars that are already being spent.
And we've been spending a lot more money on college education. I mean, excuse me, K-12 education over the last 30 years. Illinois is a good example. Chicago is a prime example. And yet 18 of our 50 most populous cities have urban school systems that are right around the 50% graduation rate or less.
Look, that's a problem with the entire system.
It's a problem with
educators or education. And it sure as heck is not a problem of simply not giving enough funds. I mean, I'm tired, frankly, of the burden of proof always resting on the good men and women that are actually doing a very hard job educating instead of the burden of proof laying squarely on the people that are wanting to cut it.
Art,
why don't you tell me, Pat, what would be a good criteria?
Let me let Art get in on this.
Let me make two points. I trekked over to hear Al Shanker, a long time, very powerful head of the New York Teachers Union, speak to the Economic Club of Chicago some years ago. I worked at the Ford Foundation after graduate school, and Mr. Shanker had handed our president, McGeorge Bundy, his head on the subject of school reform, and Shanker, epitome of the tough-talking New Yorker, said, look, when I graduated from high school in New York in 1941, there was no discipline problem, because if you were a problem in the classroom, you were out. Discipline was the responsibility of the mother and the father.
I'm going to let you make your second point, Professor Art Sear, after this break. Dan Proft in for Bruce Dumont on this edition of Beyond the Beltway.
Thank you for the first point.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Dan Proft in for Bruce Dumont this evening on Beyond the Beltway. Thank you so much for joining us. My guests from my left around, Professor Khalil Marar, he's a professor of Middle East Policy at Governor State University in suburban Chicago. Professor Art Sear, he's the director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And Pat Hughes, he's a real estate attorney and former Republican Senate candidate in Illinois. I was trying to get to the tawdry conversation about Trump and Cruz and their war of words over wives, but you gentlemen have forced me to have a high-minded discussion about culture and academia. And before the break, Art, you were talking about kind of the state of affairs on college campuses when you're omnipresent at one. And so kind of pick up where you were talking about the kind of academia and the culture there.
Yeah, well, we've been talking about K through 12 education, and in fairness to the poor beleaguered teachers, who are a very popular political target, we asked the schools to take on responsibilities of discipline, which used to be the responsibility of the mother and the father, I underscore father, in the traditional home. Secondly, I'm always glad to talk about Carthage College, although I don't want to turn it into a commercial. We just completed a major capital investment, a $40 million science center. 25% of our undergraduates are natural science majors. That's a nationwide trend, especially after the recent fairly long and very severe financial crash and then recession. Students are very, very vocationally minded, I can assure you, even in a liberal arts environment. The center of gravity on the faculty, at least in the liberal arts curriculum, not so much in business, science, and the professions, is clearly on the left. There are reasons why intellectuals are drawn to the left, and that's a long academic conversation. But you're absolutely right. There is a bias in academia. The media tends, understandably, to focus on the most extreme and outrageous cases of censorship and even occasional violence.
Well, there are so many to choose from these days. But the one thing just about K through 12 education, there was a piece in U.S. News and World Report this week about K through 12 school systems on the verge of bankruptcy.
Yeah.
$1.7 trillion in unfunded pension liabilities and general liabilities.
Well, Chicago's Exhibit A, right?
It is Exhibit A. Illinois is Exhibit A. And just to give you the state of play in terms of the economics of this, okay? You know, this once upon a time, teachers, other public sector workers made a little bit net less for job security and a good benefits package. Well, that isn't the case today. Public sector workers, for example, just use Illinois as the example since I know it so well. Public sector workers here make 27% more than their private sector counterparts. Chicago public school teachers retiring today, 30 years in, will have paid on average $133,000 into the pension system. They will receive back on average $2.1 million. $133,000 in, $2.1 million back. You're a private sector worker with a 401k. You have to put $1.4 million in to project $2.1 million in return benefits. That is unsustainable, and it's unfair, and it's not antipathy towards teachers. You know, I had great teachers growing up. It's why I have a phony baloney job on the radio where I get to talk for a living, because I had good teachers. Everybody likes teachers, and they respect that good teachers and good professors are like artists. But that doesn't mean anybody gets a blank check. And it seems to me that's the conversation that we're having across so many civic institutions, K through 12 education, higher education, the welfare state, whether it's Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, all the drivers of and budget busters of state budgets and the federal budget.
So I wore Exhibit A.
Look, I mean, you want to talk about, first of all, those numbers have been disputed. I'm sure that everybody at this table would agree that there is a different perspective on this, and not just one that's based on numbers, one that's based on perspective, right? The truth is, when you're talking about pensions at the public sector, the state, whether it's at the local level, the national level, is shirking its obligation to its citizens. Thomas Jefferson said that an educated citizenry is essential for democracy, if I can paraphrase that great thought. The point is this. The point is that the reason that we have a public education system is because we want an educated citizenry. And if you look over at some European countries, specifically the Nordic countries, they pay their teachers and they prize the craft of teaching much more than anything else in society.
Yeah, but here's the problem.
And as a result, you have an educated citizenry that would basically clean our clocks in some cases.
Well, but at least, you know, shards of that citizenry. But here's the problem. In our urban centers, disproportionately minority, children are not getting educated, and they're not getting educated at exorbitant prices. And that means something should change. And it's interesting that the people in charge of the system, and, you know, again, the biggest, the largest city run by a Republican is San Diego. So we're talking about Democrat-controlled cities and Democrat-controlled public sector unions, Chicago being a good example, that have destroyed public education, that are not educating children, that are in charge of a system they don't want to change, but they don't want to defend, which means they're benefiting from the status quo. And that's a conversation that we should be having because it is a national problem, Illinois just being the worst example as it is in so many respects. It is a national problem. Urban centers where the majority of Americans live, not educated, not sustainable in terms of the financial model.
We have
are the numbers. It's math.
Dan, we have a national education problem. It's not one that says we should cut funding, and it sure as heck is not one that says that we should basically throw out public education, throw out the baby with the bathwater. That would not be good for the republic. That would not be good for the idea of being an American.
Change how money flows and who gets to make spending decisions so that the public sector unions aren't self-dealing with the politicians they control.
That's not true.
Let's go to Daniel in Ocala, Florida. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
Hey, I'm a teacher.
Hi, Daniel. Thanks. Okay.
And the reason I'm calling is you guys are talking a lot about education. Being a teacher, I have strong opinions on this and thoughts. One of the things I think we're failing, especially you're talking about kids in urban areas, is we're teaching to one standard for all kids and acting like all children are on the same level in the same grade. The standards are the same for every sixth grader, seventh grader, all the way up. And I teach at a Title I school, which is a lower-income school, and a lot of the issues we're finding when they get to my grade, seventh grade, they're on a second, third, fourth grade level in either reading, math, which makes it impossible for them to hit those levels. One thing I want to ask, maybe why can't we move to some kind of a tracking system where we place students in based on ability groups instead of just socially promoting them to grades up so they don't fail out? With No Child Left Behind, I found that we started just promoting kids so that schools don't lose funding, so that they don't fall, you know, behind like that. And that's one of my biggest worries. And with our education, is that students with third grade levels are making it higher and higher up, where it becomes impossible for them to catch up, and then they become behavior problems in the class and other situations like that.
Daniel, thanks for the call. Great point and a great question. Who wants to tackle that about individualizing the tracks?
So I think I'll start. You know, I've got three kids, a 15-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 10-year-old, and I think that's an innovative idea. But the problem you have with that is the reason why the education system's been structured the way it has been since the beginning of time. It has to do with the maturity level, the physical maturity level, and emotional and mental maturity level of the kids at the different grade levels during that time. So based on that example, this seventh grade, let's say a seventh grade boy who's 13 years old would be in class with, you know, 9-year-old boys and girls. And that's the real problem. It's how do you bunch those things together from a social, physical perspective? I think that's why it's been structured this way since the time.
Yeah, I get it. That's a fair point. But in the digital age, what about individualized curriculum within the same classroom?
Mm-hmm. You mean like online classes, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. For example?
It's a good supplement, but since the beginning of time, education has been a personal experience, and online education absolutely has a role to play in that. But I don't think at the expense of the classroom experience. There's something that is, as you said earlier, artistic about educating, and it cannot take place outside of the classroom in the same way without the right modality.
Let me ask you the academics, Art and Khalil, a question about the kind of students they see, especially over time. And Art, let me start with you because you've been at Carthage College for some time now.
Mm-hmm.
The quality of the students, their preparedness for post-secondary work today mm-hmm. as compared to 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
Oh, well, the quality of our students has steadily improved over time. That has to do with our effective management and marketing the college as much as anything else. We've become a very popular school. Students get a lot of individual attention and should. It's a costly experience going to a liberal arts college, although the sticker price is not what people actually pay. Our Clausen Center is named for Tom Clausen, who went on to considerable success as head of Bank of America twice in an earlier time of better bankers, in my view, the 70s and late 80s. In between, he ran the World Bank. a great philanthropist, a very honest man. Like most senior executives, I wouldn't call him particularly sentimental. He was good at sharing credit, and he always felt the college gave him, he didn't come from any particular advantage in downstate Illinois, gave him the overall education, including taking into account his emotional and, you know, physical maturity, as well as getting an education. People are changing profoundly when they're in college, as we know, and as they do through K through 12.
Khalil, your experience at DePaul, at Governor State?
You know, at Governor State University, first and foremost, we are the lowest cost public university in the state of Illinois. But the beauty of that low cost is that it actually buys you a lot. We're the only institution, and since I've had a lot of experience with liberal arts institutions, we're the only institution that's actually a public institution that treats students as if we are a liberal arts institution. It's not easy. It's very challenging. It's very difficult. But we basically give them a liberal arts education at the lowest public education price, and I'm very proud to be a part of that organization.
All right. We're going to I promise, if there's one thing we do tonight, we're going to get to the National Enquirer on this show. We're going to get to the National Enquirer.
That's why I came.
Exactly. Trump and Cruz, the National Enquirer. Dan Proftin for Bruce Dumont on this Beyond the Beltway.
The beauty of Amling's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amling's now at 888-880-TREE. The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Dan Proftin for Bruce Dumont on this edition of Beyond the Beltway. Thank you so much for joining us. Our roundtable is Khalil Morar. He's a professor at Governor State University, a professor of Middle East policy. Art Sear, also a professor and the director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College
Thank
in
you.
Kenosha, Wisconsin. And Pat Hughes is an attorney, real estate attorney in Chicago, as well as a former Republican Senate candidate. And Pat, we talked about the optics of President Obama in between baseball games and tangoing, talking terror. Not great optics for Ted Cruz and Donald Trump to be having a Twitter war about their wives against the backdrop of the terrorist attacks in Brussels either.
Yeah, I think I'm going to give most of the blame here to Trump because he was really pretty nasty about it. I was a candidate for the United States Senate, and if someone had attacked my wife in that way, I would have made a public statement about it for a couple of reasons. Number one, I'd want to show the public that I would stick up for my wife. Number two, I'd want to come home. So those are the two reasons why
yes.
I think that Ted Cruz...
In reverse order.
Exactly, why Ted Cruz did what he did. So I thought what Cruz did was appropriate. He didn't say anything bad about Melania, and there isn't a lot bad to say about Melania.
No.
But Trump was beyond the pale, which is his standard thing, and you know he gets away with it, so he continues to do it.
Trump was beyond the pale, and he gets away with it. I certainly agree with that. And it's too bad that it's come to that in our system.
And we have a National Enquirer story that, again, so the Trump camp was accusing the Cruz camp of being behind the half-naked picture of Melania. Now the Cruz camp is accusing the Trump camp of being behind this National Enquirer story that alleges that Ted Cruz had a number of affairs, one staffer who has denied it and called it outrageous and tabloid smut and all the usual things you would say about the National Enquirer, which although it has
– John Edwards.
It has sort of been
John
a paper
Edwards.
Of record on
yeah.
this issue specifically, but – But it doesn't mean that they should be given the benefit of the doubt either, I wouldn't say. But so just the nature of that. And frankly, in this day and age where you have the gruesome prospect of Bill Clinton going around the country flacking for his wife and that sham marriage that they have, does it even matter anymore if Ted Cruz did have affairs? I think it matters, but does anybody care?
I think the average American cares. I mean, look, if you look at the numbers, according to consistently across time in America, the biggest sin that you could commit, social sin that is, right? Not talking about murder or anything like that, is infidelity, right? 90 to 95% of Americans consistently say that infidelity is unacceptable, that it's wrong. So I think we still have that core. The question is why it doesn't matter in politics. And I think that really gets us back to the notion that the reason that the ordinary, the average, whatever, Joe and Jane and whatever is very upset is because their politics are no longer reflective of who they are, their morals, their virtues, what they want out of life, what they want out of education.
So does the rise of Trump and Hillary and then this kind of Ted Cruz story, and again, I'm certainly not authenticating it, but it's a story that's out there. It's going to be talked about. But does it suggest that, look, we expect everybody in politics to be a moral reprobate, so we're building that into the price. And so Trump and Hillary, yeah, they're moral reprobates. They're untrustworthy, and I don't like them. But I'm voting for Trump in one camp, and I'm voting for Hillary in another camp.
Right. I mean, that is the problem. I think you hit it on the head, is that this idea of being a moral reprobate is no longer something that the political system actually vets, that the political system actually cares about. And I think that this is not about morality here. This is about reflection. This is about ideals. This is about what is right and what is wrong. I think that most people have a sense of right versus wrong. And yet their politicians are not reflecting that at them. And somehow we're supposed to be okay with that. We're not okay with that. And the fact that the politicians don't share the reality of the average American is really reason for a lot of upset, lot of tumult, and a lot of anger.
Well, Art, I mean, Donald Trump, when Hillary started going after Trump, Donald Trump brought up the specter of Bill Clinton, and then that got tamped down. Now, I mean, Donald Trump going after Ted Cruz, he says he doesn't care. He doesn't know if it's true or not. The typical kind of Donald Trump and passive-aggressive insinuation. But, of course, Donald Trump, was a tabloid fodder in New York City for decades, and he left his first wife for Marla Maples, and that was a whole soap opera in New York City. So he's not exactly on the moral high ground there. Hmm. But I mean, are people essentially saying, though, character doesn't matter? I mean, to Khalil's point, it used to be the president of the United States, that's somebody that of character and gravitas, and we aspire to that person, and their personal conduct matters. Does Trump and Hillary suggest that their personal conduct doesn't matter anymore?
I don't think it's that simple. In fairness to Mrs. Clinton and the Democrats, they've been spending their time discussing policy issues. She has been accused of financial impropriety. My own personal belief is she engaged in conflict of interest, and her husband has done so outrageously in financial matters. But I wouldn't equate her or Bernie Sanders with Trump, who actually doesn't have policy views. He does. It's a stream of consciousness series of mostly insults and very general statements, including some extremely irresponsible ones in foreign policy. I would make a somewhat different point. I don't believe our previous leaders were inherently virtuous. We were more innocent collectively. I think since Watergate, we have every aspect of somebody's personal life is fair game in the media. That didn't used to be the case, obviously. And there are dramatic examples in both parties of very successful men whose personal lives were left off the record. I think we've developed a breed of politician who is not necessarily profligate, but quite the reverse. We have maniacs running for office who are single-issue conservatives or liberals who are so intense and so uncompromising and so sanctimonious. I actually prefer the earlier days when we were not so prying into politicians' personal lives.
Well, this could be the problem with Ted Cruz if any of these allegations turned out to be true, Pat Wright, is because he does try to occupy the evangelical moral high ground on matters like this.
Well, he sounds like a TV preacher more than a politician, doesn't he?
Yeah. It's the conservative double standard when it comes to these things, right? If a conservative strays, then they're going to get annihilated for it because of what they're preaching when they would go forward with their point. And so there is a double standard.
And that's the last word. My thanks to Art Sear from Carthage College, Pat Hughes, Chicago attorney, and Khalil Mulrar, professor at Governor State, for coming in on this Easter Sunday. Beyond the Beltway is a Genevieve production. I'd also like to thank Colin Babbitt, Fritz Goldman, and Dan Dorfman for their assistance getting this program on the air. I'm Dan Proff, substituting for Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
Eight years ago, there were barely more than 400,000 television homes in the entire country. By 1952, the 400,000 had grown to 18,700,000. By August 13th of 1956, there will be 36,800,000 homes in the United States equipped with television.
For more historic clips, go to museum.tv.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City at Hilton University.